This is Point of Inquiry for Monday, January 20th, 2014.
Hello and welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy and the co-author of a provocative essay in this week's New York Times entitled, Is the United States a Racial Democracy? Stanley and his co-author Vesla Weaver, a professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Yale, argue that the disproportionate surveillance, imprisonment, and post-conviction voter disenfranchisement of black Americans threatens the very integrity of our democracy. 2013 found 2.4 million people in prison in the United States, more than four times the number in 1980. The rate of black incarceration has risen even faster than the rate of white incarceration. Prison has consequences that last far beyond the sentence. If you have ever been to prison, you may permanently lose the right to vote. You may face discrimination in housing and employment for the rest of your life. In theory, prison is supposed to reform offenders, or at least sequester them until they are ready to rejoin mainstream society. In practice, the stigma of having gone to prison pretty much guarantees that you can never function in mainstream society again on the same footing as someone who's never been to prison. A democracy is supposed to be representative. What does it say about our democracy when millions of people are relegated to permanent second-class citizenship, including not being able to vote? What should we conclude when these permanent second-class citizens are disproportionately of one race? As skeptics, we know that we often see what we want to see. Sometimes our fervent belief in equality can blind us to the evidence that equality remains elusive. Stanley and Weaver are a dynamic intellectual duo. Stanley, a philosopher of language and epistemologist, is working on a book on the philosophy of propaganda. He studies how political speech can be used not only to express the speaker's ideas, but also to subtly silence opposing views. Weaver is the author of Policing Citizenship, America's Anti-Democratic Institutions, and the New Civic Underclass. Their essay, published on Time's philosophy blog, was a surprise breakout hit. It was the 9th most emailed and 12th most tweeted item on the entire New York Times website. Rarely does an essay that cites Plato, Aristotle, and Dewey beat out modern love. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's start by asking the really basic question. What do you mean by a racial democracy?
Racial democracy wasn't perhaps the best term. What we mean is a racial oligarchy in classic political philosophy terms. An oligarchy is typically defined in terms of class. Like, an oligarchy is a system where there's a property requirement on voting. So you have to have a certain number of, perhaps you have to have a house in order to vote. Alabama actually had race and oligarchy connected, the racial issue and the class oligarchy connected, because they had a certain amount of you had to have $300 or something like that in the early 20th century. That was the means by which they disenfranchised black voters. So the two, a class oligarchy and a racial oligarchy, aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. But the original title of the piece was actually Racial Oligarchy, which captures the notion we're after more closely, but requires a lengthier initial explanation. So a racial oligarchy is one in which there's a race requirement on voting. And just like a class oligarchy, where there's a property requirement on voting, or a dollar sum requirement on an asset requirement on voting, it's not a democracy. Because as John Dewey says, the idea of a democracy is the idea of community. It's coming together, it's all of us being in one community, taking everyone's perspective into account and making policy together. And having a community in which only part of the polity can form the laws is just not a democracy.
So how many people are disenfranchised in this way right now in total?
Now, disenfranchised legally by, say, felon disenfranchised, disenfranchisement, which is, I think, is 13%. But my colleague, Vesla Weaver, is the criminologist.
So that would be 13% of African Americans?
Well, Let me check that. The 13% of African American males, I think. But let me check that. The more important work point that Weaver and her colleague at Princeton, Amy Lehrman, discover in their research is that in addition to the massive black population in our prisons, it's 39% of the prison population. In addition to that, there are 13% of the population and the 39% of the prison population. And if you look at just black males, they're 35% of the prison population, prison or jail. And, of course, you can't vote if you're in prison or jail. So that's disenfranchisement. So actually being in prison is disenfranchisement. You said at the start of the program that black rate of incarceration has risen faster than the white rate of incarceration. It's risen four times as fast as the white rate of incarceration. The increase in black admissions from 1960 to 1997 is 517%. If you look at the graph of the increase in black incarceration over white incarceration, black incarceration just goes straight up. So we don't think felony disenfranchisement is, there's sort of an excessive focus on it, given that there's only two states that have it. The real problem is, I mean, the two real problems. First, the massive over-incarceration of black men. As we say in our piece, over 9% of the world's prison population is black American. So, you know, you'd expect there to be over 600 million black Americans. So, but Weaver and Lehrman discover that just having exposure to the police leads you to not politically participate. And that's a crucial discovery because we know that black neighborhoods are massively policed.
So what they found is that things like stop and frisk and day-to-day involuntary contact with the police are correlated with lower rates of voting?
Yes. So here is the exact statistics from Weaver's amazing, Weaver and Lehrman's work. The probability of voting declined by 8% for those who had been stopped and questioned by the police, by 16% for those who had experienced arrest, by 18% for those with a conviction, by 22% for those serving time in jail or prison, that's after they get out. And if the sentence was a year or more in duration, the probability of voting declined by an overwhelming 26%, even after accounting for race, socioeconomic position, self-reported engagement in criminal behavior, and other factors. So that's the real crucial extra element. And this is this focus on disenfranchisement. I mean, one of the sad things, although you know, we've seen mass incarceration, we've seen the rate spike. What's terrifying is if you go back and look at the literature on black disenfranchisement, you know, this has been the story since Reconstruction. I mean, Du Bois in Chapter 9 of The Souls of Black Folks writes, can we establish a mass of black laborers and artisans and landholders in the South who by law and public opinion have absolutely no voice in shaping the laws under which they live and work? Can the modern organization of industry, assuming as it does free democratic government and the power and ability of the laboring classes to compel respect for their welfare, can this system be carried out when half its laboring force is voiceless in the public council?
Some people might think or assume that being discouraged from participating in politics is a fairly minor punishment compared to being locked up or being fined. But in the essay, you talk about how it's really one of the most profound ways that you can disrespect and degrade a person.
People might say, look, what are you talking about? So people don't vote. Who cares? You're not limiting their liberty. You know, they can still wander the streets and buy candy canes or chocolate bars. So what's the problem? They're dissuaded from voting, but they've got liberty, right? That's a fundamental confusion about liberty, the role of liberty in Western philosophy. We don't, certain kinds of speech, let's just take our own polity, the United States, certain kinds of speech receive special protection. Political speech that is contribution to political debate, that receives special protection. Gossip does not receive as much special protection as that, like advertising doesn't receive special protection. We have laws governing what you can say in advertising. Political speech receives special protection because deliberation, to deliberate in the public square, is, as Aristotle argues in the Politics, what it is to fulfill your end as a human. Of course, Aristotle believed some people were natural slaves and women could never do this, but one of the main points of our piece is these ideals that we track over the centuries, there's always this huge complexity negotiating between them and reality. In some sense, they interfere with reality. You have this wonderful picture sketched by Aristotle amidst this, these chapters that are interwoven about how people, some men are everywhere a slave. So, but Aristotle thought that the liberty that a political participation to deliberate and play a role in the policies that govern you was the highest form of liberty. Now, various political theorists have wanted to say that there's just one kind of liberty and that's just one aspect. But even if you say that, it's distinguished. It's more important than buying a chocolate bar at the bodega or the convenience store. To take that away is to take away your input into the policies. And if you have no input into the policies, then, Du Bois, again, no one's better than Du Bois on this. Frantic efforts must be made at critical times to get lawmakers in states even to listen to the black man's side of a current controversy. Because if you're not voting, why should your side be listening?
And you can argue that the legitimacy of the democracy itself lies in the breadth of adults that it represents. And even if nobody's individual rights hypothetically were violated by being discouraged about voting, that the democracy itself simply isn't representing as many people, that points of view are left out.
Absolutely. It's just not a democracy if policies are being formed that govern the behavior of some in the community when they have no input into the formation of the policy. The idea of a democracy is something that is a system that maximizes liberty. There's different conceptions of liberty. I've said that political participation is a particularly important form of liberty. But the basic idea of a democracy is we're all supposed to forge our own paths and have the freedom to forge our own paths through the world. And when a policy constrains our liberty, it must be because we view that policy as in our best interest. Now, if you're not one of the R that's being considered and you're subject to that policy, it's not a democracy. You're a subject. You're not a citizen. That's what a subject is. That's why we had the American Revolution, because we were subjects and we had no input into the policies that govern us. And that's how we're treating a lot of our black citizens.
You write in the essay, the philosopher Elizabeth Anderson argues that when political ideals diverge so widely from reality, the ideals themselves may prevent us from seeing the gap. How does this process work when it comes to racial democracy or racial oligarchy?
Well, I think for me, and the reason that I was, one of the many reasons I was excited to come to Yale, I first realized the Elizabeth Anderson point, when the Anderson point is also, I think, in Charles Mills, to a certain extent, in the racial conflict. I'll get to that later. But when I read the Special Weaver paper called Frontlash in 2007, the point was driven home to me, and I only discovered the Anderson later. Weaver, in Frontlash, shows that the policies that led to mass incarceration happened simultaneously with the Civil Rights Movement, that as the Voting Rights Act was passed, people relaxed, and people wanted to believe that the ideals were furthered, not satisfied, not realized, but furthered. And then Weaver argues that just at that time, people set the foundations for the large burst in prison construction, two massive crime bills, one signed by Johnson in 1965 and the other by Nixon in 1968, and then the mass incarceration starts in the 1970s.
Michelle Alexander writes in Jim Crow that the very phrase law and order originally attained its currency as a kind of code word for opposing integration and then kind of took on a life of its own. Is that similar to the phenomenon you're describing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think Weaver and Alexander's work, those are the two figures that, for me, most, both of their work overlaps. I think those are the two figures who were first working on this, and that is exactly what happened. I mean, that's what both of them show. Front Lash tells some of the same story as the new Jim Crow.
So it was both that people who were anti-racists relaxed and people who were racist were energized and then began waging this campaign of law and order that everyone acquiesced to because they thought, oh, well, we're in the new era of civil rights now. There couldn't be anything bad about cracking down on criminals and a
race. Law and order is great. Now that we have voting rights, and now that they have political participation, why don't we go for law and order? Who can be against stability? There are all these, and this is the shift to the theme, a major theme of my book. There are all these political ideals. Stability is one. Freedom, democracy, those are political ideals. Liberal democratic political ideals. Humanity, justice, those are all political ideals. The political theorist Carl Schmitt, who became the Nazi Party's chief intellectual, so, you know, you want to take what he says with a grain of salt, said when you hear political ideals, the language of political ideals, they're always being used to justify strategically. To get you to do something that's not in your interest. And he has a wonderful discussion in particular of the concept of liberal democracy. He says humanity has no enemy. You can't have a war for the sake of humanity because there's no enemy, at least on this earth. But, and then he says, the fact that wars are often waged in the name of humanity doesn't contradict this through this simple truth. It proves it. Because what you're doing when you wage a war for humanity is you're claiming that your enemy isn't human. You're wielding humanity as a strategic weapon. And law and order is used as a strategic weapon against some members of the polity to exclude their voices.
So if you're in favor of the forces of law and order, then you're implicitly casting anyone who questions whether we need all this incarceration, questioning them as lawless or dangerous?
You certainly have that feature. I think in this case, that's not what's going on. There's certainly cases that I talk about in my book that have exactly that structure. The Patriot Act has exactly that structure. I mean, 6 weeks after 9/11, it's passed. It's called the Patriot Act. It contains these very unpatriotic things because patriotism is pride in our nation's political ideals, such as, you know, the Bill of Rights. And it's as unpatriotic as you can get. But it's called the Patriot Act to exclude those who oppose it from the polity. If you oppose it, you're anti-patriotic. So that case has a structure that you described. I think these appeals to law and order aren't directed against those who object. They're meant, okay, everyone can accept this. But they're meant to justify something that has always occurred in the United States. And I'm going to read from Du Bois one more time. This is 1903, and it's terrifying because he says, thus grew up a double system of justice which erred on the white side by undue leniency and the practical immunity of red-handed criminals, and erred on the black side by undue severity, injustice, and lack of discrimination. So, that's 1903. And that differential justice system remained in place. You know, that's probably a description of the two different American justice systems, one for blacks, one for whites, that has existed since the Republic has come into being. So, when you're for law and order, you're for applying the system of law. You're applying the system of law and order. Who can be against that? But the reality is you have two different justice systems. Two radically different sentencing policies.
Do you feel like the idea of colorblindness, the idea that the United States is a colorblind society where everyone gets a fair shake, has become part of our patriotism narrative to the point where when people start pointing out inconvenient evidence of inequality, it's almost as if they're questioning patriotic ideals?
Yes. And now you are saying what Charles Mills says in his book, The Racial Contract, which is the book that sort of shook me to start originally thinking about these things, and it explained to me what I found so disturbing about political philosophy during my tenure as a philosopher, during my time as philosopher, because as you noted, it's a new area for me. So he says, what you just described is what Mills in The the racial contract describes is the function of those ideals. So he is a darker criticism of those ideals. So towards the end of the racial contract, he talks about how the mainstream conceptions of the policy themselves, I've just opened it, and which portray it as essentially raceless, whether in the dominant view of an individualist Marxist liberal democracy. So he says that the ideals of liberal democracy are portrayed as raceless, and that has exactly the function you say. And that's Mill's critique in the racial contract of the ideals of liberal democracy themselves.
How does he think we should reconceive the ideas of liberal democracy to get a more truly egalitarian result?
Mills is not an ideal theorist. So he's not someone who thinks that, the way to do it, and this is the idea I'm also playing around with, and we play around with in the piece, but we don't go as far as Mills as condemning the ideals themselves. And Elizabeth Anderson's also suggesting that ideals are themselves problematic, that they have this essentially blinding function. I mean, Mills is saying it's in the nature and purpose of the liberal democratic ideal to make you think that if you think about race and talk about race, then you're not really doing political philosophy. You're not really doing, ideal theory. You're not really talking about the central issues. And so that's the rottenness at their very core. The Anderson point is more talking about, thinking about the ideals has a blinding function. It tends to make you overlook concrete instances of social injustice. And the mechanism by which that works is still mysterious. Tommy Shelby, the great Harvard political philosopher, is pushing me on this.
So if ideals are blinding us to real-world problems, what do we do differently? I mean, we do, in fact, substantively want a colorblind society. How do we go about pursuing one without some kind of ideal to guide us?
I'm not sure. I wonder if we do want. It's not really clear what colorblind means. Elizabeth Anderson has a lot on that. I'm not sure we can even risk thinking that way. I mean, that's my view of those ideals. We can't even risk, given the role that race, ethnicity, has played in injustice, we can't think that way. We can't think that.
But is there a corresponding, is there some alternative ideal that we could replace it with in terms of equity? I mean, it would still be an ideal. We'd still have the problem of ideals blending us to concrete realities.
Right. So one of the things I'm thinking about in my book is how do you have ideals motivate you, yet prevent them from having this blinding function? Another thing to do is just to say, always be suspicious when you encounter ideals. And just go from one concrete instance of injustice to another. But something must guide you, and the guidance must be some kind of ideals. I just can't see how you can do away with having some kind of political ideals that guide you. But I think colorblindness we should get rid of because it does too much damage. We should just assume that race is always going to be something that people are going to be sensitive to. We're so far off from ever coming near. I mean, we do all of these surveys. The Justice Department does. We do employment surveys over and over again. I see it with my students. I see it with the family members of mine who are asked anecdotally. I see it anecdotally, and I see it confirmed time and time again, which is that we are an especially race-conscious society at all levels. So to even talk of colorblindness as an ideal seems so dangerous that I think we should put it aside. And Anderson has conceptual objections to what colorblindness is supposed to mean. We do know we have all sorts of reactions to race. Given that we have these reactions to race, what are we supposed to do? Ignore those reactions? So I mean, we're in a situation now where Black Americans face great obstacles everywhere, and people think they have great advantages. So there's a study that I just read, I think it's a top study, let me look it up now, that says that white Americans now think that there's more anti-white bias than anti-Black bias, which is just absurd if you do any kind of survey of handing out CVs for jobs. But you know, it's extremely dangerous time for that reason.
And of course, a lot of media outlets like Fox News are doing their part to stoke the reverse racism narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what reverse racism would even mean in a society where so many of our black fellow citizens are in such dire conditions. And when we have time and time again, you know, I mean, I'm constantly seeing that. I'm constantly seeing among my students, I'm constantly seeing them saying to blacks and women, oh, you're going to have an easy time of it. You know, you're going to have an easy route to employment. And I've actually never seen an instance of affirmative action in my life. You know, I mean, I can say that. I mean, maybe a couple, maybe one or two, but I've seen blacks tend to face a higher standard because people are suspicious affirmative action is being employed. So, and people are assuming you'll get often when a black philosophy candidate, for example, goes to the market, people will assume, okay, they're going to get lots of jobs and they won't interview them and they'll get very few interviews. So, you know,
so it's kind of a game theory thing where everyone assumes, oh, this person will be so popular we shouldn't even try?
They say that. I can't quite believe they believe it.
It sounds hard to believe.
Yeah.
But people literally do say that, like, oh,
yeah,
we could never get so-and-so.
With women candidates as well. I've encountered that in philosophy. We're shifting. When you shift from the prison industrial complex to the philosophy industrial complex, you've made a big conceptual leap.
Does the term reverse racism function in any of the ways that you've been characterizing as, you know, propaganda, as silencing opposition?
Oh, yeah. It suggests that. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely intended. Racism is a charge that, I mean, when you charge someone with racism, what you're saying is you're trying to exclude a group of people from the democratic polity. You're saying their perspectives are not worth listening to. Even if you're a gentle racist and you say, okay, I'm a gentle racist, I think we should take care of them. You're saying their perspectives don't matter when you're designing the laws that apply to all of us. And so reverse racism is the charge, you know, is that charge back at. When you accuse someone of racism, you're saying you're trying to drive me out of the community. And reverse racism is the charge that blacks are trying to drive whites out of the community, which is absurd because whites own the community. How do you drive people away when they own the means of production, they own the factories, they have all the wealth? Can't drive them away. I mean, reverse racism, I mean, would be throwing a pebble against a massive stone wall. I mean, it has no effect. Whereas a racist, I mean, I don't even know if it's...
So you're saying that the concept of racism really only makes sense within a structural... when there's a structural disadvantage at play. So it's not just one person's bigoted opinions or one person being mean or one person shutting out other people, that really what racism is that way of thinking combined with an entire support network around you to reinforce it and multiply it?
I could have said it better myself. The reason racism is such an intense charge is because it is easy to exclude black citizens from our community. And when you're accusing someone of that, you're accusing them of taking someone who's relatively powerless. And, blacks have great agency and have militated, not to say they're powerless, but don't have the economic equality that they ought to have. And you're threatening them even more. You're threatening them by saying, you know, I think your voice in deliberations about what to do is not a voice we need to pay attention to because you don't have the capacity for a reason. You just can't do that in the reverse direction when the structural inequalities are so large because, you know, what are you saying? If you say to a person who, you know, is part of a group that is always going to be, that has the political power, you know, you're excluding them from the community. I mean, what would it be for a group, black Americans are 13% of the population, to exclude the vast majority of America from the community when, furthermore, that vast majority owns much of the resources of the community? So,
One final question, Jason. As an expert on propaganda, what can people who want to turn the discourse around do? Are there ways that we can talk and put ideas forward that will be more effective at opening dialogue rather than cutting it off?
Well, when you look at the comment thread on our piece, you see something very frightening. So what you see is a string of really dire comments about race. You see white supremacist comments. So I'm trying to find one of the comments to give you a sense of what I mean. So what you see is people saying, okay, there's this group that just really doesn't belong in the community. That was the sixth most popular comment was one that said, could it be that one group just doesn't belong in the community with the rest of us? And when you see that, you see a certain inability to, if you think, in multiple traditions, political philosophers say, this is how democracy works. You've got the project of public reason. Habermas thinks this, Rawls thinks this, where citizens engage in discussion and governed by reasonableness. They take everybody's perspective into account. And if you think that people are uncivilized and live in horrible conditions, when you recognize that and have suffered grievous past harms, which every American, I think, recognizes about Black Americans, they've suffered grievous past harms. And your attitude towards it is they just have to suck it up and get over it and realize that they should wear their hair like us, they should wear their clothing like us, they should be like us, or else it isn't going to work. I would describe that as, you know, pretty much the definition of an intractable situation. If I was one of a group that whose grandparents and parents were terribly treated by your group, and you say to me, the problem is because you don't act like our group and don't have our norms, you're not civilized like we are, you start acting like us and, you know, we'll treat you with slightly more respect, you know, that's just not gonna cut it. So I'm not optimistic, and fortunately, I'm a philosophy professor. My job is not to recommend the solutions, but to call attention to the problems. And I can't think of a way forward under those conditions. I can't think of a way forward when people think of Black citizens as diseased and problematic and uncivilized and ungovernable and just have to act like whites to, you know, just have to drop their connections, their pasts, and their past grievances in order to be part of the polity, because if I was one of those people, those wouldn't be conditions I would accept as reasonable.
Well, you've done a really compelling job in drawing attention to some very concerning problems, and I thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to Point of Inquiry. My guest today has been Jason Stanley of Yale University, discussing his article in the New York Times, Is the United States a Racial Democracy?